fans. We have a delightful guest today, Jim Boat. And we're going to start with the speed round. But what I want to say right off the bat is, again, another LinkedIn connection. We were talking pre-show that he may have seen me in San Diego a long time ago, way before COVID. Apparently, I was not memorable enough. No, just kidding. But as Jim just said, he was kind of just getting into the space. So, and we're going to hear about the space as soon as we do our speed round. So when I say fraud, what do you think of, Jim?
Danger.
Oh, danger. I like that one. I don't think I've had that answer. Okay. How about ethics?
Integrity.
Oh, I've had that one, and I like that one a lot. And then finally, and you may or may not have an opinion, who makes better embezzlers, men or women?
Ooh, women.
Oh, you said that. What is your basis for that?
I think they're a little more careful. Oh. And think things through, maybe a little less impulsive.
Oh, okay. I just had some in the week before, two professors, and you know, they're not in the world of really embezzlement whatsoever, and they kind of had the same opinion that men are a little more flashy, women are a little more, you know, patient and things like that. So that's interesting. Okay, so Jim, give the fraudish audience an elevator speech when you go to, say, a social event and someone says, "Hey, Jim, what do you do?"
I fight fraud. I fight fraud mostly through education and training related to prevention, detection, fraud risk assessment. So kind of pretty heavily front end loaded. And I educate, I do training with organizations, their employees, their boards, as well as through the university, hopefully teaching a few future fraud fighters within my, you know, fraud examination and forensic accounting classes.
And so how did, at age 5, did you say, "I'm going to be a fraud fighter," or how did you get to where you are?
I certainly didn't do that. Although, you know what's funny? It's interesting when you finally start to find your niche or your passion. It's always interesting to go back to your childhood and go, "Well, duh, I knew it then. I just forgot." This is probably way before your time. But I used to love to read when I was a young man, a kid. I used to love to read this series of books called Encyclopedia Brown.
Ooh, and, interesting.
And of course, and plus I was a big Hardy Boys fan too. But Encyclopedia Brown, this was probably a little bit younger. But what they did is, this was a kid and in a small town. His father was chief of police in this small town. And he solved mysteries around the neighborhood. But the stories were set up so that they walked you through the story. You got all, you know, his process, his thought process, his investigation, his, and then it stopped. And you had to take what he had come up with and solve it. And then you could go see if you were right. And I couldn't get enough of those. And so, yes, I intuitively knew then. I don't know how I do, but it took me a long time to come back to that. The way I ultimately came back to that was I was in banking for many, many years. And it was all, I found out real quickly, I didn't like to tell people, "No, you can't have that loan." So I said, "I want to go in the back office. I want to be where the action happens, where the money moves." And I went into operations and very quickly ended up in payment systems. I built check processing systems, credit card systems, lockbox. I was involved in every kind of aspect of payment. Well, that's where the sausage is made, so to speak. I mean, you get into all the nitty gritty details. And when you're, especially when you're starting something from scratch, I was starting this for organizations that hadn't done this before, savings and loans, when they were first authorized to do that. I was building these from scratch. Well, when you do that, you have to build the policies, procedures, but you also have to plan for what could go wrong. And it was through that whole process of building these that I really started to dig into the fraud side. What could go wrong? Kind of the dark side of payments. And that's where my interest started. And ultimately, I went on to get my master's degree in economic crime management, became a certified fraud examiner, and then leveraged my lifelong dream to teach and decided this is what I want to teach. So that's how I got into it.
That is so awesome. And from the previous weeks with Simons and Shabri, we talked about what's missing. So clearly you were looking in systems like what's missing so a fraud can happen. Does that seem mm-hmm. right?
Right. Because you start to look at, what could go wrong? How could people take advantage of the system? Because you have to design the controls. And I learned real quickly, I didn't have the mindset of a criminal. It's like, I have to train myself to think, how would I take advantage of the system? How would I break this? Those kinds of things. And that was a process to learn to do that. So that's one of the things I work on in my training is you've got to think you've got to learn to think that way. And the biggest way to do it is to say, if I was in here and I needed and I wanted to take advantage of the system, if I wanted to take this money, how would I do it? And so, yeah, that's really where it started is trying to figure out, well, what are the internal controls that are necessary to build this system properly? And so you had to figure out what could go wrong or how the system could be broken or taken advantage of.
Yeah, so I use the example for like unbanked people. And, mm-hmm. You and I pay our bills probably online. Maybe we mail some, but like we have checking accounts, we have debit cards, we have credit cards. And we don't think about how do unbanked people pay their bills. Therefore, right. Utility districts get ripped off a lot because there's cash payments. And now you and I wouldn't think like who pays their utilities in cash? Well, there's a lot of people. And I just taught a class and someone pulled up the statistic that in 2021, and the number has increased, I'm sure, since then, that almost 5% of the people in the US are unbanked. So you take 5% of everyone's utility or whatever bills, and they're paying by cash. And that could be a hole.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because you can't track it. It's much more difficult to keep track of.
So we have to think differently. We can't just think in our own little bubble, like everyone pays their bills like I do. No, not everyone pays their bills, especially, not even criminals paying their bills that way. But the people, the clerks, the county clerks, the water district clerks, they're like, huh. Really, we take cash. I didn't know that. There's a funny story I show about a clerk in Palm Beach County who took strippers need to be licensed. Mm-hmm. And do you think strippers are going to pay with, a Visa card? Probably not. So she started stealing the registrations of strippers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't pay my registration for the ACFE with $2 bills. I pay it online. Right. So we have to think differently. And I like that you clearly know to think differently.
Yeah. And again, it's for somebody that, when you'd have that ethics, those ethics and you have that integrity and you would never dream of behaving that way, it starts to be a stretch. And so, again, you have to train yourself.
Yeah. OK, speaking of training, we are going to give a shout out and hopefully it's going to be March 28th. It looks like it's going to be March 28th. You are doing the second Fraud Leadership Summit. So tell the fraudish audience, what is the Fraud Leadership Summit? And I know you did it last summer and I wasn't able to be part of it, but I get to be part of it now.
I'm so looking forward to having you on there. It was really, I can't even tell you where I came up with the idea. It's just one of those things where you see a couple things out there and kind of an amalgamation comes together and you go, oh, I want to do something different. And, you know, we go to trainings where we have a panel with multiple people on a panel, or we have breakout sessions where we go see this person and then that person. And particularly during the time of the pandemic, when we still had to continue with our training, right? So we did that online. Well, okay, I'm going to confess, when I'm doing training, I multitask. You know, I check, you know, my calendar, update my calendar. You know, you're doing these things while you're training. Well, when you are sitting in, even when you're engaged and even when you're listening, you're sitting in on a 30, 45, 50 minute training. We have times where we tune in and out, and no matter how engaging the person is. And so what I thought is, how do we short circuit that? And so what I did is I had this flash of speed dating. You know, you see, especially like on comedies on TV, and they talk about the speed dating, and these people just rotate from table to table. And I've never done this, but you rotate from table to table and you have like 5 minutes or 10 minutes to connect with this person, to tell them who you are, who they are, and so on, and connect with, and then you're on to the next one. And I thought, I'm going to do that with this Fraud Leadership Summit. So I invited, we had about 10 fraud experts, just from my network, people that I knew, and but some very, you know, good names, like Kelly Paxton, although this time around, and said, I want you in 10 minutes to just give my audience your best advice. If you had 10 minutes to talk to someone and just say, this is what I'm passionate about, this is what I really believe in, and bring it down to 10 minutes. And we did 10 minutes with 10 different experts. And then we had a question and answer. And the people that attended just loved the format. They said there wasn't that dead time. It was you only get 10 minutes with this expert, so you're engaged the full 10 minutes. And I don't know how I was able to do it, but we kept everybody on time and on track. And just, it got great reviews. And so I'm looking forward to just doing it again with some of the same experts and some different experts. I was asked once, you know, well, do you have a theme for it? And I try to kind of stay away from that, because I want each expert talking about what they're passionate about, because that's going to get the most energy and the most bang for the buck for the audience. So that's what we're doing. We're going to do it again, and I'm really excited about it.
I love that. And, you know, as a speaker, it's easy for me to blather for 2 hours. 10 minutes to get the best, it's hard. It is hard. Mm-hmm. You work much harder doing a 10-minute presentation than you do for a 2-hour presentation, because there's right. No slides, most likely, or if there are slides, you have to pick the best. Right. So I'm really looking forward to it. And it's to tighten things down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To tighten things down and to really give a wide variety in a relatively short period of time. You know, in that couple hours, you know, people are going to get information, you know, get expertise from 10 to 12 experts.
I know when I've gone to some conferences, you know, the sessions are 50 minutes, maybe an hour and a half. And sometimes I'm like, 10 minutes into it, I'm like, no, this isn't right for me. It's, you know, I don't like to get up and leave, but I'll want to get up and leave after 10 minutes. I most likely won't do it. But the fact that, you know, you could get that 10 minutes is just, I love the idea. I'm going to put in the title, Speed Dating Fraud Style.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you're teaching, which I love to do. I don't teach at a university. You do. But what are some of the concerns or questions that your students most often have?
You know, I think one of the difficulties is that They don't even know what their questions are. You know, my students are predominantly accounting majors. And so they're coming in and they've had cost accounting, they've had financial accounting, tax accounting. And it's my fraud examination course is an elective course. So I generally don't get them until they're seniors, usually a semester or two before they graduate. So when they come into that class, I ask them, you know, why did you take this class? Well, it sounded more interesting than the other electives. And I needed an elective. I mean, I get that a lot. But then there are occasionally you get some that say, you know, this is something I'm interested in. But for most of them, they don't even know that it's out there. They don't. When you ask them, you know, when they are thinking career paths, they're thinking, well, I want to be an auditor. I want to go into tax. I want to go to the Big Four. I want to go to a mid-sized regional firm. But very few of them say, I want to go into forensic accounting practice, or I wanted to get, a lot of them don't even know it exists. So they don't know the questions, you know, they're before they even have the questions. And sometimes that's a little difficult from the teaching perspective, because you have to speak to the questions that they don't know they have. But at the same time, that leads to one of the most rewarding things when you open their eyes and they say, I had no idea this existed. You made me rethink my entire career path. And that only happens, you know, that happens once or twice a semester, maybe. But I think the other rewarding part is that I'm convinced, hands down, that even if they aren't thinking about it as a career, it will make them a better auditor. It will make them a better tax accountant. It will make them better. And I mean, I actually have my own, my own judgment about that. I think it's my opinion that every business related major, business, finance, accounting, every one of those should have a class in white collar or financial crimes. I think it should be required.
I also think ethics.
Well, that, yes. And fortunately, at least from my experience, that is required. But for whatever reason, I don't understand why people don't see the connection and require that or make it or encourage that more of the business majors. Because you know what it leads to without that? It leads to the naivete that I see out there when I go talk to CFOs. They're the ones that are saying, well, I know that's out there. I read about it all the time, but it doesn't happen here. I have a good team. I trust my team. And that's, I think that if that kind of education was required, where we educated them about what the risks are and that nobody's immune to it, it's not a matter of if, but when. If you start to cultivate that early in their careers, then I think they have a respect for the risk and understand it, and maybe take a little bit less of a naive approach.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine going to med school and not learning about disease, just learning about, you know, good health? I mean, it's kind of the same.
Right. It's like,
do doctors not learn about cancer or, you know, whatever else it is? No, you have to learn about all of it. Now, you might not specialize in it, but I mean, I think that's a really good comparison that you're making. Mm-hmm. You got to know the whole world of business.
Right. I mean, you're asking who's responsible for the internal controls of the organization? Management. But you didn't train them about what the internal controls are supposed to stop. So how can they develop and design quality internal controls?
Well, and I mean, I've struggled with that in my career, that a lot of people don't want to hire me for prevention. Like, they're like, right. We hire people we know, like, and trust. Why would I, you know, bring someone in who's just going to be a downer? Well, I'm not a downer. And I can show you any industry, any geography, whatever, you know, and it's not negative. I mean, it's not. But I think they really think it is a negative thing and a downer.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So the fact that you get a couple of students a semester, I think is fantastic. I just taught a class online and a guy messaged me in the chat and he's like, I'm really interested in the forensic accounting. He's an auditor. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I joke, I would have probably been a better auditor because I like to help people.
Right.
And investigations, I joke, it's whack-a-mole. One beep and then another one pops up. And whereas when you're an auditor, you're really trying to improve things and to see holes. So I probably should have been an auditor.
Right.
And I didn't know about performance auditing until about 12 years ago. I was like, auditors have to be accountants. And now, you know, I coach and mentor a lot of young professionals and they're like, I didn't major in accounting. I can't be an auditor. It's like, oh, there's a lot of different ways to audit. And one of the smartest young professionals I know was the one who introduced me in performance auditing. And we were at a fraud and ethics class. And I was like, so what do you do? And she's like, I'm a performance auditor. And I was like, what is that? And, you know, she's half my age. And she's a municipal auditor for a pretty big city now. And I've seen her career. She's one of the smartest young people I'd ever come across.
That's fascinating. Can I share a secret with you?
Absolutely.
I don't have an accounting degree.
I don't either. My dad made me take one accounting class. You know what? That's interesting because my dad made me take one accounting class. He's like, if I'm paying for your college, you're taking an accounting class. Because I was like, oh, I want to do international studies. He's like, what? You want to travel the world? I was like, well, maybe. He's like, I'm paying for your school. You get one accounting class. And I think I got like a B- or C+. But I remember the first class, the professor says 30% of you won't make it to week two. And I was like, well, I have to. My dad's paying for my school. I didn't mind it. I like numbers. However, if I saw a course saying fraud examination, I would have taken that course immediately.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the whole pink collar crime, the fraud leadership summit. If you just said, you know, if we don't have something that is eye-catching and causes people to pause for a second, go, hey, you know, we have to make it interesting for people.
No doubt.
Yeah. And the people that you are, you know, that you had last summer, and again, my apologies, I was on a little bit of a sabbatical, and that you're having in March is like, it's a testament to you and all the work you've done that people are willing to do this with you. Because like, it's, again, to do a 10-minute presentation, I'm going to have to work at it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because you have to work at it. But if someone asks us to speak off the cuff about fraud or even about a specific part of fraud, it's easy for most of us. But the minute they limit you, and then you've got to think, okay, I've got to be selective, and I want to make it count. And I actually teach a course of that's communication writing and communication and presentation skills for accounting majors. And I tell them one of the most difficult things is to narrow down your subject.
Oh, yeah.
Is to narrow down your subject, because a lot of times you think, well, I only have 30 minutes to speak. So that just means we try to fit what we want to say into the time instead of the opposite of saying, no, let me fit my content to the time rather than, okay, I have a lot to cover, so I need to talk. I need to talk faster. No, that's not the way it works.
I mean, I like the rule of threes. I hired a coach, you know, it was pre-COVID, and she actually coaches attorneys, which is shocking that I went to someone who coaches attorneys, but I did because she's so good. And the rule of three, she's like, you got to keep it to three, Kelly. Like, you have so much information, but you've got to pick your three best things for this audience. And you've got to say the three things, do the examples of the three things. And when you close it out, remind them of the three things twisted a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So like one of my three things is there is no honesty chromosome. I say that at the beginning, at the end, I say, remember, women are not more honest than men. It's the same thing, but it's just tweaked in a little bit different of a word.
Right.
So I love the power of three, and I'm going to probably do the power of three for the Fraud Leadership Summit because it'll keep me on track.
But it works. It works.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about this. We had a pre-call and everything like that. And one thing that, and you said you don't do it very much anymore, but I really enjoy this, that you did this. You did the Jim Maxwell Leadership Training. And everyone I know that has done it has, whether they do, quote, leadership training or not, they say it's been a very good experience training-wise.
You know, I totally agree. And, you know, there are times where I look back to the time and money I invested in it, and I thought, you know, I could look at it and say, I really didn't do anything with it as far as monetizing it or, but it's permeated everything I do.
Yeah.
It permeates how I conduct myself. It permeates, I bring it to my students. No, I don't teach a leadership course, but you can bet that leadership is sprinkled all throughout. And it's, because all leadership starts with self-leadership. And if we're not, and that's the first place we have to start, whether we're going to officially go on and lead others or not, we have to start there. We have to start with, okay, how can I more effectively lead myself? And so, you know, the lessons are priceless. And, you know, I think, well, how much did I really leverage it? I leverage it every day.
Yes.
But it's in pieces and bits. But I talk to my students about leadership every day. When I go into an organization and talk to them about, you know, you've got to train your employees and make them aware of the risk and what it looks like. That's leadership. Too many organizations have this mindset, you know, if you see something that doesn't smell right, that doesn't look right, I want you to say something, right? Whether that's spoken or unspoken, that's kind of the attitude in organizations. Well, you fell short because you didn't tell them what to look for. You didn't tell them, you know, if something doesn't look right, well, what's it supposed to look like? Or what does it look like when something doesn't look right? You know, we want people to speak up about fraud or things, you know, things that don't look right or smell right, but we don't tell them what those symptoms and red flags are. And so what do? We go in after the fact. I love to tell my students this. We go in after the fact, and the two things we always hear. Number one, Mary in accounting, she's the last person I ever would have expected, ever would have suspected, right? That's number one. Number two is the recollection, ending with the shrug, the recollection that, you know, now that I think back, I can remember, you know, that something didn't look right or whatever, but I just figured, you know, that's what it's the shrug with the words, I just figured, and they let it go.
Love that.
Because they knew it and they can go back and they could connect it, but nobody trained them at the time to say, no, this isn't right. This doesn't look right, and I really should say something.
Well, Monday morning quarterbacking. Especially when, you know, the cockroach theory, everyone scrambles when, you know, they see the cockroach, but yeah. And then it's like, well, you know, when I call her Gladys, not Mary. When, you know, Gladys shows up in a brand new Range Rover and she's making $18 an hour, it's what we call a clue.
Right.
Even though she could have a side hustle or, you know, but still, it's just maybe to start to sort of pay attention. So kind of like finishing up here, and we didn't talk about this, and but because you have students and they're generally younger, and I love to teach the fraud and pop culture class, is there any pop culture movies, books, podcasts that your students either brought to your attention or you brought to their attention that maybe the fraudish audience would like to know about?
Ah, so, you know, I have an assignment every semester in my fraud examination class, and I call it At the Movies.
Oh my God, I love that, At the Movies.
And I have a list of white collar crime themed movies. And I just say, I want you to pick one of these movies, watch this movie. And then I give them an outline and I say, I want you to take the movie and frame it in the context of what you're learning here. How does the fraud triangle or the other fraud theories we've learned about, how do they apply here? What are the red flags? What are the preventive or detective things that could have been done that might have short-circuited this? So I have them evaluate, well, what's the theme of this movie? You know, what was the scheme that they use? And there's almost always multiple schemes, as you know. But I have them, and they watch it from a whole different perspective. And so it's a favorite. And so some of the favorite movies of the students, they love The Wolf of Wall Street. Catch Me If You Can. Gosh, there's a whole bunch of The Accountant is a favorite one. And it doesn't matter that they're dramatized and spectacularized, because in the core of it, there's still there's still the thing, the themes, there's still the what is it that caused this person to do that? Were they more of a predator type fraudster who they were looking for somebody to take advantage of? Or were they more, and I hate this term, the accidental fraudster. I like to call it the incidental fraudster, because there's nothing accidental about fraud. Or the coincidental fraudster, the one who is in a trusted position, who typically has too much access because of the trusted position they found themselves in. And then they end up on a slippery slope where they have medical bills or tax bills to pay or whatever. I mean, that theme has been repeated ad nauseum, you know, in case after case. But they get on that slippery slope. Then they find out, oh, this money's kind of easy. I'm getting kind of hooked on it. And then they transition into more of a predatory type individual. But you can apply this to, like I said, to a whole ton of movies. And it's fun to watch the students pick this apart and find these things and see these things. Because I think it's part of training. One of my goals is to train them in what I like to call the investigative mindset. And that is, if it doesn't look right, don't just shrug it off. You know, pursue it until you get an answer that makes sense.
Yeah. One thing, and I don't know if you tell your students this, I always tell when I teach, classes especially, is you always have to, and I've made it politically correct, or I've cleaned it up a bit. You always have to have a walkaway fund. Mm-hmm. Because if you're an auditor, if you're an investigator, at some point you may have a senior person ask you to cross the line. And if they do, you know, it's never going to end well.
Right.
In my 20s, I didn't have the walkaway fund. However, I had the appearance of the walkaway fund. I've never been asked to do something. I've had a peer who was asked to do something. And yes, they did it. Because they didn't have the apparent, they had the pleasing appearance. I apparently have the resting bitch face appearance, and he wouldn't dare ask me to do it. So yeah, we're going PG a bit. So, but I always counsel, you know, young professionals, you have got to have a walkaway fund.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that you just said reminded me of. Why do you think when the FBI is doing background checks on agents, and this would apply not only to FBI but other government agencies. Why is it so crucial that they do a credit check?
Yeah, so I did over 1,000 background checks for the feds, and I believe it was O2B. They had 14 codes, and O2B was the financial code, and it was late payments. It went like A to D. And we had these things called special interviews, spins, and that was the number one, that and underage drinking, because I was in Wisconsin. But yeah, the financial, it's huge. It's a, yeah.
Well, if somebody wants to get access, and I'm going to use a term that you would see in a movie. If somebody wants to turn an FBI agent, who do they look for? They look for the vulnerable. And who's more vulnerable than somebody who's in financial trouble or heavy in debt?
Yeah.
That's why, that's one of the key reasons why those things are looked at, because they can't afford to put those individuals out there that are that vulnerable.
And everyone thinks money is going to be a long-term solution. It's a quick fix to something that needs to be long-term. So if you can't live within what you have, you're going to have to readjust your budget. But everyone thinks, well, if I just pay off that one bill, I'll be okay.
Right.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. No, the financial was the biggest thing for background investigations by far. The state of Oregon, you can't run a credit check unless it's certain positions. And you know what? I mean, in this country, we have bankruptcy based on medical bills. So if someone's bankrupt, you can't hold that against them. A lot of times it could be due to medical bills.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, and every bank that I ever went to work for, I had, you know, not only I, you know, I, you had a credit check. You had to. Why? Yeah. You're around money. You're working around money. I mean, it makes complete sense.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, I am so glad that we finally, like, I had sabbatical, then I had a little siesta, that we finally made this happen, because this has been so good. You guys need to go. And where's the best way to sign up for the Fraud Leadership Summit? Is it link? Well, first off, connect with Jim on LinkedIn. He posts.
LinkedIn is going to be where I do most of the promotion. And I'll put it out there, and it'll be advertised and promoted there. But hook up with me on LinkedIn, because I also will create, you know, if someone wants, I'll add them to an email list, and I will also notify people via email.
Awesome. This is so good. I thank you so much, Jim. And I am looking very forward to the summit.
All right. Well, this was a pleasure. I'm really glad I could do it. And I look forward to having you on the summit. So
awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everyone that ultimately listens to this.
Absolutely. We have lots of fraudish listeners.
All right.